Today is October 27th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Luther Jones over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Luther, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in October 29th, 1948, in Pocatello, Idaho.
Well, happy birthday coming up.
Thank you.
And tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Okay, although I was born in Pocatello, I spent all my elementary through high school in Blackfoot, Idaho, which is about 20, 25 miles north of Pocatello. So that's really where I grew up and took all my schooling there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your family.
My family is a kind of a typical family. There were six kids, four boys and two girls. And my father worked for what was then the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, at the nuclear reactor site west of Blackfoot. And spent his time developing plumbing for cooling reactors. My mother was a, typical 50s housewife. You know, she was home with the kids and did all the home stuff. And she was a Sweet Adeline singer, so she was in Sweet Adelines for many years, singing barbershop quartet.
Huh.
I have one older sister, and the rest are younger than me.
Okay. So what were your earliest athletic pursuits?
So I started, in a small town like Blackfoot, I think everybody starts out doing little league baseball, and then you kind of pick up little things after that. But I played baseball for several years before I started playing basketball in junior high school. That's about the earliest I could start. And by then I was already almost full grown. I was quite tall. I think I was 6'2 or 6'3 in the seventh grade, so I didn't grow much beyond that. I think one or two more inches is all. And so I played basketball through junior high school and high school. I also played football in high school, and I did some track and field events. I did high hurdles and discus and shot put. So I had quite a varied background as an athlete, but nothing that would be earth-shattering, I guess.
Okay. Well, how did you first get involved in your Olympic sport?
So I was a rower in the Olympics, and a local high school coach, a guy named Coach Williams at Snake River High School, which is a competitor of ours and our arch enemy, actually was on a mailing list for Ted Nash, who was the freshman rowing coach at the University of Pennsylvania. And Ted Nash would send out letters to coaches throughout the country and say, do you have anybody that's, 6 foot to 6'5" or 6" and weighs about 200 pounds and could get into Penn and might be interested in doing that? And Coach Williams sent my name to Ted, and I got a message from Ted saying, that I'd been recommended and would I like to apply. And at that point, it was about the strangest thing I'd ever heard of, because I'd never actually seen a boat or a rowing shell or rowers or anything. So it was quite an unusual letter to get, and all my friends made fun of me, row your boat and all that stuff. And so I said, well, I'll think about it. And he said, well, if you'd like to come back and visit, come on back and I'll take you around and show you what the sport's all about. So I did that. I went back in, I guess it was March, to Philadelphia just for a weekend. And it was like going into Oz. In Idaho in March, it's really kind of bleak. And I landed in Philadelphia, and it was, you know, it was hot and humid, or warm and humid, and they took me to the water, and the water was just glassy flat, and the cherry blossoms were in full bloom, and it was about the prettiest thing that I think I'd ever seen. And so I thought, well, you know, this is quite a sport. It doesn't look that hard. You know, I think I could probably do it. So I applied and was accepted sometime later. And that's kind of how it started. You know, I went back to Blackfoot and actually met another guy from a neighboring school who was also recommended, and he and I both decided to go. We were both discus players, so we sat around the discus ring and talked about what we would do in Philadelphia rowing, and end up having quite a nice conversation there.
That's good that you kind of already had somebody going through the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, both of us made the freshman team that year, the first freshman team, and we were undefeated national champions after the first year.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about some of your biggest competitions during your college career.
So I started rowing my freshman year, and my objective at that point was just win the national championship as a freshman, and you know, we had to beat some, you know, all the other Ivy schools and schools from Washington and Cal and Wisconsin and, you know, Navy. So it was kind of the biggest objective was just to win all those races, and we did, as a matter of fact. So after I'd been rowing for 6 months, I was named captain of the crew, of freshman crew, and then, you know, we were national champions, and I was actually ready to head home to Idaho. My father had driven cross country to pick me up and drive me back to Idaho with my brothers. And I got a message that the head coach wanted to see me, and it was Joe Burke, who was a head rowing coach at Penn, and he asked to see me, and so I said, okay, why not? And at that point, he asked me if I'd like to row for the trials in the eight, which would have been the varsity eight. So I said, you know, okay, I'll do that. And had to send my father home without me. Luckily, I had all the stuff I had packed in my suitcase was all I had. So I just went back to Philadelphia and started rowing. And kind of the biggest race at that point was that we had to beat Harvard in the trials, and Harvard had beaten Penn in two races that year already. And so Harvard and us were the favorites going into the trials in Long Beach. And we ended up not winning. We lost by 4 inches, and they passed us at the last stroke of the race. So we were ahead for, you know, 2,000 plus meters, or 1,999 meters, and they passed us in the last stroke. And they were the 8-hour champion, and we went back to Philadelphia to try again. And I tried. I was eventually won the trials in the four with Coxon. So that was kind of the preamble to the Olympics and the trials. I rode on three other national teams, including the 72 Olympics, and I rode in the World Championships and the European Championships as well.
Mm-hmm. So tell me anything that really stands out in your mind about the 68 Olympic trials.
So the biggest thing was I was so young. You know, I wasn't yet 20, so I was 19. And I was rowing with people that had won gold medals in the trials, you know, in not the eight, but in the four with trials. There are people who were medal winners in previous Olympics, and I was pretty blown away, I guess, by kind of where I was in my life. You know, I was, at the time of trial, that I'd only been rowing for like 10 months. And here I was trying to make the Olympic team. It was quite an amazing event. Of course, I was disappointed to lose in the eight, but the four, we really dominated the race the whole time, and it really wasn't that close.
Mm.
But the trials themselves were in Long Beach, and it was a beautiful facility, and it was a good place to row, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah. How did your family and friends and people who knew you at school, how did they react to finding out you were going to the Olympics?
My high school friends, I think, thought it was really, really, really cool. In college, though, I didn't really have that many friends because I was basically a rower and a student, and I didn't have any time to do anything else. And so I didn't try to fraternity, and I didn't have any outside clubs or anything. I was just trying to get through school and row during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So my college life was pretty Spartan. I did, the people in Blackfoot where I grew up, were really supportive, and they were, they gave me a lot of positive feedback on what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. So once you made the team, was your training and preparation for Mexico City different than the training that you had been doing?
It was quite different. I'd been training in Philadelphia for basically 9 months, and then we had to go to Gunnison, Colorado. And Gunnison, Colorado is, in the middle of the mountains in Colorado, so it was, the altitude was certainly an issue. It took us, a couple of weeks just to be able to do normal kind of pieces, with the difficulty in breathing. But, that really wasn't the part that was the most different, but because we were rowing at a place called Blue Mesa Reservoir, which is a man-made reservoir with really no trees around it, just sagebrush and grass and rocks and things. And so it was quite windy there, as opposed to in Philadelphia where the wind wasn't so bad. And, as we were training, it went from kind of late summer in Colorado to fall to early winter. And so, we were rowing in snow flurries by the time we were getting ready to, be sent to Mexico City. So it was quite a change in not just altitude, but weather, and the humidity was, like 0% the whole time. So it was quite a bit different from a weather standpoint as well as the altitude. And I think that probably hurt us more than anything, because we had trouble getting our pieces in and trouble getting, good water to row in. So it was actually kind of a more of a hardship than a benefit, I think.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever been down to Mexico City prior to going for the 68 games?
No, I'd never been. Actually, I'd never been really out of Idaho. My first airplane flight was to go back to see Philadelphia, and I'd made a couple of by that time. But once we left Denver for Mexico City, it was my first trip out of the country.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
We landed there, and it was, of course, it was incredible to be part of the Olympic team, to be down there and be part of that process. I just remember being really happy to get off the plane and see people there and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Had you been participating in any kind of physiological tests related to exercise physiology at high altitude?
No, mm-hmm. we didn't. I wasn't part of any tests. I don't know if mm-hmm. the others at the center were. I don't believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were just doing our thing.
How concerned were you and your teammates about the altitude in Mexico City?
I don't think we were overly concerned. I think it was just something that we had to deal with. You know, you always have things you have to deal with, and that was just one of them. You know, everybody was going to be in altitude. You know, if I could have a redo, I think I would have asked or hoped to go down a little earlier because of the weather in Colorado. But, you know, really the altitude at some point was, it was more of a common denominator, and, you know, everybody had to, you know, nobody was exempt from rowing at altitude.
Right. Was lifting weights part of your training program?
We lifted as freshmen. I lifted as freshmen before the rowing season started. So I lifted from basically September through maybe March. And at that point, the lifting really was put on the back burner. We didn't do, you know, deadlifts or squats or any of those kind of things after that, I don't think. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of stadium stairs and track running. We do it, you know, in Philadelphia, we do at Franklin Field, which is where the Eagles used to play and the Penn Quakers play now. We do like 30 sets of stadium stairs, and then we do a half mile per time and a quarter mile per time every morning before we go to the boathouse, and of course do the two on the water workouts the day.
Were you aware of how your training compared to that of your competitors from other national teams?
Not at all. I was so new. I really didn't have a clue what anybody else was doing. I just knew what I was doing and how hard that was. And I think that was as much as I could handle anyway. Mm-hmm. At that point, because I was young, you know, and you know now they have U23 teams, and shoot, I'd retired after two Olympics at age 23, so wow. You know, it wasn't like I was, you know, my body wasn't probably even fully mature by the time I retired.
Wow. Who was your best friend on the Olympic team?
So probably my best friend was my roommate in Gunnison, a guy named Bill Purdy. He was a senior when I was a freshman, and you know we were roommates in Gunnison, and so we kind of did things together. The other good friend was actually a member of the same freshman rowing team that I was on, but he was on the Canadian Olympic team, so he was there as well. And so after the rowing was done, we did a lot together.
As you were preparing to go down to Mexico City, do you remember hearing anything about an Olympic project for human rights? And did you ever receive a letter from any members of the Harvard crew team?
You know, I was blissfully unaware of almost everything because I was so focused on what I had to do that I just didn't have time to do anything else or even think about anything else. Mm-hmm. So they may have sent something out. I remember hearing about the project, but it was nothing I was at all concerned with.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard about any violence, protests, or shooting incidents in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
I had not heard about that. And in fact, I had heard rumors like after... you know, probably after the games were even over. And I didn't really understand what was going on until actually about 10 years ago. I was actually working in Mexico City, and I met someone who told me kind of the story and how, you know, the Mexican government at that point was really a reflection of the protests that occurred in 68. And so I kind of learned a little bit more about it at that point.
Mm-hmm. Were you?
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you were surprised to learn what had happened.
I was totally surprised. You know, like I said, I had nothing else on my mind at that point than, you know, working really hard and trying to win a medal.
Mm-hmm. So, what were your first impressions of Mexico City and the people there when you first arrived?
So I think my first impressions were how welcoming the people, how welcome the people made us feel, you know, because whenever we had, you know, from taking the bus, even from the airport, there were all, you know, the streets were lined with Olympic signs and stuff, and it was amazing the amount of, the show of support that there was. Plus, every time a bus would pull into the Olympic Village, there'd be thousands of people there trying to get autographs and pictures with their friends and things, and so it was, you know, people that I saw were all so friendly and so welcoming to their country. I took Spanish in high school, so I could even talk to them a little bit. But you know, it really was pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, going from the Olympic Village to the rowing course, which is near the floating gardens of Xochimilco, they're just like across the road from each other. We'd drive past these lava fields where people had kind of hauled out the lava field and put, you know, tin roofs over their houses and cardboard roofs over their houses. So there was just incredible poverty too, you know. So there was kind of the Olympic Village attitude, and then there was the, you know, the drive to the race course attitude, which was the visibility was just, it was like the opposite. It was like squalor.
Mm-hmm. Did you, aside from going to the village and to the race course, were you able to venture out into the city and see any of the sites?
After the rowing was completed, I did. I went to the Anthropological Museum there, and we, you know, wandered around, had street corner tacos, and, you know, had a pretty good time after the racing was over. But before that, really, no.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the event venues and athletic facilities?
I thought they were wonderful. The rowing course was a man-made rowing course, so it was, you know, the right distance, and there was plenty of room to warm up and work out and stuff, and so that the rowing venue was quite nice. It was next to the Xochimilco Gardens. I think, I don't remember if we rode on it or just took a boat tour through it, but it was just beautiful to see all the, you know, the flowers and the things that they were growing out there. So the rowing venue was wonderful. The Estadio Olimpico, the opening ceremonies were, was also, you know, very nice. Everything that I saw was nice.
What were your impressions of security measures at the 68 Games, and how would you compare security in 68 to security in 72?
Well, so in 68 it was I think not strenuous. You know, there was security, and we had to go through checkpoints and things, but it was fairly open, and you know, I think that was the way it was supposed to be, and in 72 that's the way it started. But certainly after the massacre in the village and then at the airport, things got much tighter and it was much less fun.
Yeah.
I think 68 and it was kind of the last of the free Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Because after that, after Munich, you know, things were never, I don't think things have ever been the same.
Mm-hmm. Describe your accommodations in the Olympic Village in 68.
So we were, most of the rowing team was in maybe two, what would have been apartments. And so there was probably, I was sleeping in, my cot was in the living room, I think, of these. And there were people in, you know, a couple of people in the living room, for three or four, maybe five. And then there are a couple of people in the kitchen, a couple of people in the bedrooms. And so it was quite crowded and noisy. And, you know, the actual accommodations, the sleeping accommodations were, I think, Spartan is the best I could say. Now, once you got outside of the sleeping, you know, the rest of the Olympic Village was wonderful. You know, they had multiple cafeterias where you could eat anything you wanted to eat. And, you know, for me, that was the best part of the whole Olympic experience, I think, was seeing all the food that I could eat from every country in the world. And then, you know, they had television sets in the Olympic Village, so you could go in there and watch any event live that you wanted to see, you know, and just stand there with other people that were doing the same thing. And, you know, that part of it I really enjoyed.
Hmm. Did you or anyone you know have any problems with food or waterborne illnesses while you were there in Mexico?
I think everybody did. I don't, you know, maybe there's somebody that didn't, but I know I did. I had my Montezuma's Revenge about maybe a couple of days before my first race. So I was kind of over it by the time my racing started. But I think everybody had something at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You try to be careful, but, you know, you brush your teeth with water, and that's the wrong thing to do. And you know, so again, that's one of those things where I think if we would have been there a week earlier or 2 weeks earlier, we could have kind of got all that throughout the team and not had to worry about it again.
Yeah. Describe your most vivid memories of the opening ceremony.
So first of all, just walking into the opening ceremonies and you know, knowing the history of that process, you know, marching in as a team. And, you know, at that point, we still, you know, tried to march in, you know, left, right, left, right, left, right. And, you know, we kind of stayed together in a group, and I thought that was a good thing. You know, marching around and hearing the chants and, you know, USA, USA, and then lighting the torch, you know, that was, of course, the key.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that the people that had been in the Olympics and knew what was happening had stuff to put on their heads when the doves were released, and that was I was a novice, and I didn't get that memo somehow.
I hope that you didn't get splattered.
Oh, I did. I did.
Oh, no.
But that's okay.
Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams, aside from the Canadian gentleman that you knew from school?
You know, I think that I didn't have any specific interactions with other rowers because, you know, it really is that was kind of my place of business, you know, and that's what I did. I didn't really socialize with other rowers very much.
Mm-hmm.
I did have, you know, this, you know, 1968 was in the middle of the Vietnam War, and I did have some Vietnamese athletes come and, you know, shake my hand and say thank you for helping us out. So I assume they were South Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
wow.
You know, for sure it kind of gave... Put, you know, put a face on the war in Vietnam.
Yeah. So that was actually going to be one of my next questions I was going to ask, given the political climate and the Cold War and the war in Vietnam. I was going to ask if that colored or affected any of your interactions with people from other countries.
You know, the Cold War really didn't mean that much to me, I guess. I didn't feel like I needed to beat the Russians or to beat the East Germans or beat the, you know, whatever. That wasn't part of my mindset at all. My mindset was just to do my best and row hard. And in fact, my rowing coach actually gave a pep talk before the final and started talking about those things, and it just seemed like totally out of place to me, and I didn't understand what he was trying to get me to do, because, you know, I figured out by then that the other athletes, the other rowers, were pretty much just like me, and they had a physical agenda and a personal agenda, and it probably wasn't a political agenda.
What were some of the things that he was saying in the pep talk?
It was mostly, that we were in the finals with the Russians. They were actually next to us in the race, and it was we needed to show. I don't remember exactly, just that was the biggest part of the pep talk, and it kind of took me by surprise because I'd never heard that before, and I'd not even thought that before either. But so it certainly wasn't my motivation at all.
Right. Well, describe your actual event, the finals in your event, and any problems or challenges there. Anything that sticks out in your mind about that?
Yeah, and so the 2,000 meters is about 6.5 minutes, and so it's kind of divided into the first 500, the middle 1,000, and then the last 500 is kind of how the race goes. It's kind of like a running race, like the 800 meters, where you kind of sprint out and then you coast for a while. You don't coast, but you relax for a while and then you sprint at the end. And so the first thing I remember about the final is rowing from the basically beyond the finish line, which is where the boathouses were, to the starting line. And in Mexico City, they actually sold seats the entire 2,000 meters, that's very unusual. And, the seats closest to the finish line were very expensive, and the ones closer to the starting line were really cheap. So, if somebody wanted to watch a rowing event, they could get in for, a dollar or less to watch the rowing event. So, rowing alongside the stands is where you'd row down to the starting line. And for 2,000 meters, people were chanting USA, 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 and I had got goosebumps on goosebumps, and my stomach was all turned upside down in a knot, and I was about as nervous as I possibly could have been, I think, getting down to the starting line, and to have, that long of just, USA, USA, on and on and on, it really got me nervous. And then we pulled into the starting line, and we were warmed up. We were in good shape, ready to go. And then somebody off to the starboard side, which is my left side rowing, false started. And we didn't hear them stop us. So we went probably 5 or 10 strokes farther than we should have gone in a false start. And so we did, instead of just turning around and going back, we actually rowed probably 100 and maybe 150 meters into the race before we realized it was a false start. And so the second start wasn't as good because we had kind of shot the load, in the first shot, first start. So we had a little less successful start, and probably I was the stroke, and it's probably my fault because I was kind of still a little keyed up. And then we settled too low, and the stroke rate came down too far after the first start. And so the middle of the race, we were rowing just a little low, and that probably wasn't a good thing. And then with the altitude and everything, I started getting the tunnel vision, how you kind of lose your peripheral vision. So I don't have any memory at all of the last 500 meters, the sprint part. And so it's kind of, I can't really even describe how it ended because I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
I wasn't there, I couldn't see, and I was just working on oxygen debt at that point.
Yeah. So I've heard that several people passed out during the rowing events.
Yes.
Did you see any of those people that had passed out?
I saw a scholar. I think he was from Poland. I'm not sure. Basically, just just stop rowing in the middle of the race. And you know, I think there are probably several others that had significant problems. You know, my problem wasn't that I stopped rowing or anything. I just lost sight of what was going on.
Yeah.
So I came in fifth. So I did okay. I was like a half a boat length out of a bronze medal.
Mm-hmm.
But so we did okay, and you know, maybe if we hadn't had the false start, or maybe if I had if I could see what was going on at the end, maybe we could have done something. But as it was, that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what did you do right after your event?
So after my event, I was so stressed. I actually went downtown after the rowing. I had I had some food and went down to the event downtown and just wandered around till like 4 a.m. I was with some other friends, and so we just wandered around, and then I think I slept for 24 hours.
Wow.
Because I hadn't slept before, and it was quite stressful, and I think I missed a day.
Yeah.
So.
1968 is remembered for being the first summer games at which a drug testing program was implemented.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about the drug testing program in 68?
I remember it was like marbles or something. You'd draw a marble, and if you got the black marble, you had to go, give a sample. But nobody I knew, the only person in my boat that got the sample was the coxswain, and he was basically a steering person and kind of on-board coach. Drugs wouldn't have affected him anyway. But
yeah.
But he was the only one I think that I knew that drew the black marble or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't hear very much about it.
Mm-hmm.
In Munich. The races were almost, overwhelmingly the Eastern Bloc countries were in the finals. And so I think even though the Eastern Bloc admitted to using steroids and drugs after the 76 Olympics, I think they started earlier than that. I think they started in 72.
Mm.
Just based on the results.
Right.
But in Mexico City, I don't think it was such a big deal then, or maybe I was so naive still that I didn't notice.
Okay. The Smith and Carlos protest on the medal stand, did you witness that in person or on one of the TVs?
You know, I think I heard about it the next day. I don't think I know I didn't witness it. I only attended, I think, two events that weren't my own. After I was through racing, and that wasn't one of them.
Mm.
You know, I heard about it, and I heard that they were sent home, and I think my thought at that time was, if you're gonna make a protest, you better be willing to assume the consequences, and I think that that's kind of what they did.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like Snowden that did what he did and then left the country, and not suffer the consequences. So I think that they did I give them a lot of credit for doing it and then, accepting the consequences.
Hmm. What were the two events that you got to go to?
I got to go to a fencing event, and I got to see one track and field event. It was the night that Dick Fosbury was jumping, so I got to watch some of that.
Oh, wow. So you saw the famous Fosbury flop?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah. So at least for the rowers, I don't know how it was for the rest of the folks, but almost all of the tickets that were available for the rowers went to coaches and coaches' wives.
So, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because they had more time.
Yeah. I guess that's true. So the media and TV, did anybody mention whether or not your races ended up on TV back in the States?
I found out that my event was on television in the United States. I forget what day it was, but it was on fairly early in the morning, and so people were able to watch it. It's not been made available to me. I wish I could get a copy of it. Like I said, I don't remember much. It would have been nice to have seen it.
Yeah. Have you tried contacting, I think it was ABC, maybe ABC that might have
footage? I've not tried personally. I've asked around, and people said that ABC is not, they just don't share that because it's their property.
Gosh, that doesn't seem very nice.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, well, hopefully you'll get to see it at some point. Keep looking on YouTube because more and more stuff keeps ending up on YouTube.
I know. I actually saw one of the rowing events. They had like 30 seconds of rowing on it, and that was good. But that's the only one.
So any other really memorable or interesting events that stand out in your mind from those games?
The closing ceremonies, by far, were closing ceremonies is what kept me rowing for another 4 years.
Oh, really?
So in 1968, the plan was to have selected athletes carry flags into the closing ceremonies and everybody else sit in the stands and watch. And I was sitting there patiently waiting for the thing to go happen. And when the flags got in, athletes kind of en masse just went on the field. You know, it was against plan for sure. And so it was very spontaneous, and it was such a joyful feeling, you know, at that point, because, you know, we were all together, all together as a group of athletes and not as any country affiliation at all. Many of us didn't even have our uniforms on or anything. So we were out in the middle of the Olympic Stadium and just dancing around. And, you know, that part of it was just, that was incredible. And then at the end it said, Auf dem München, or until Munich, or see you in Munich. And I thought, you know, by golly, I hope so. And that was kind of my mantra for the next 4 years.
Wow. So what did you do right after the games were over?
So I actually landed. I took a flight back to Blackfoot, and I'd taken leave of absence from my university because I was going to be gone for more than two-thirds of the semester. Went back to my hometown, Blackfoot, and actually got engaged and married before Christmas. So I went home and married my high school sweetheart and stayed there till after Christmas and the New Year's, and then both of us kind of went back to Philadelphia and lived there.
Oh, wow.
So it was a year for me. You know, I started rowing. I won a national championship. I won the Olympic trials, I rode in the Olympic finals, and I got married. So,
yeah, that's quite a year. Wow. So tell me about Munich, some of the big things that stand out in your mind from making the team again in 72 to, just what happened there.
Mm-hmm. So, I had hopes to go to Munich, but, you know, as it was working out, the odds weren't in my favor because I was in Philadelphia and a lot of the Olympic training was being done in Boston. And so I had, you know, I was working, you know, at that point I'd graduated and I had to work, and my wife was working in Philadelphia, so I had to stay there. And so I was kind of limited in who I could row with because many of the other rowers were up in Boston. So I end up getting in a pair with Mike Staines and a coxswain named Aaron Herman, and we trained for a while and end up winning the trials. And at that point, you know, my reaction to winning the trials was, I think, scary to my partners in the boat, because I was screaming and yelling and splashing water, and I think both of them thought I'd kind of lost it. But, you know, for me, it was like, okay, I'm going back. You know, this is what I wanted to do. I'm going to go back. Mm. And so I got back. I went back there, and we trained for a while, and went over to Munich, and we were doing pretty well. You know, we won our heat, and then kind of the wind turned, and instead of being a tailwind, which is what the course was built for, it was a cross headwind, and during our second race, we'd won the heat, so we were in the semifinals, and then the semifinals were on the far right hand side, which is the windiest and the choppiest. So we had, you know, by far the worst conditions of any of the boats in the race, and so we didn't make it to the finals, but we did okay. We got 11th. Mm-hmm. And my wife was able to join me at that Olympics, so she actually got to watch the racing. And and after my racing was done, she actually snuck into the Olympic Village. This is where it gets a little strange, because she had snuck into the village using a forged ID.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Israelis were murdered, she couldn't leave the room because she would have been thrown out. She didn't have any place to stay, so she had to stay in the Olympic Village with me in the room for a few days until we finally just gave it up and left and went home. Actually, we went to Amsterdam, but we just kind of gave up on the experience at that point.
Yeah. So the attack happened after your rowing event?
Yes. Our rowing event was over, and maybe just by a day or two. I don't remember the exact sequence, but you know, we heard that there was something that was going on, and all the TV was German, of course, and we didn't understand German. So we were kind of watching the TV, trying to figure out what was going on, and down below us were the military with their submachine guns in their gym bags and sweatsuits, trying to look like athletes. And they're trying. The terrorists were still in the village at that point, and so we were kind of on lockdown.
Mm.
And then when everything moved out of the village, the security was just so high that you couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
So we smuggled food up for my wife and another one of the rowing wives, and went as long as we could before it just became too painful to even be there.
Yeah. So you guys ended up leaving before the games concluded and before the closing ceremony?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, frankly, at that point I was done. You know, I was done with rowing, and I was done with the Olympics, and I was ready to just move on.
Yeah. Was that because of, you know, what had happened, or just in general you were done with rowing?
For some reason, the head of the World Rowing Federation didn't like me. And we were, you know, maybe 10 seconds late to the starting line in the heat. And he was following all the races. And he actually got out of his Mercedes at the starting line and came over and yelled at us for trying to ruin his regatta. And, you know, like I said, we were maybe 10 seconds late to the starting line. And then when the And that's the second time he demonstrated that to me. But the first time was in the previous year in the Olympic and the European Championships. He called the boat I was in the girls four, because we all had long hair at that point. And so he made fun of the girls four from the United States, and that was us. And so in 2 years, he pretty much let me know that I was not going to be on his list of favorable athletes. And I don't know why.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that, and then when the racing started, the water was so bad and the racing was so unfair that they should have canceled the races, but they didn't. And come to find out later, it had to do with TV time. They wanted the eight on during prime time, and so they made everybody else race in the bad water. So at that point, you know, I'd kind of given up on the sport.
Yeah.
And frankly, a little bit on the Olympics.
I don't blame you. So, what did you do after you got home from Europe in 72?
So mostly what I did is try to move back west again. We were ready to get back into the mountains and the sweet air in Idaho, and so we basically just worked for another year to save some money, then moved back to Idaho. Ended up, so that was 1973, and that was the gas crisis. So we had a Ryder truck that got 10 miles to the gallon and a 10-gallon tank, a 15-gallon tank, but during the gas crisis, there were no gas stations open after, 5 o'clock. So you could only drive between 8 and 5 and 55 miles an hour was governed, and so it took us a long time to drive cross country to get back to Idaho. But we were glad to be kind of out of the East Coast.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about amateurism and your experiences with amateurism, and how you would compare amateurism as it was in the days that you were competing in the Olympics versus what amateurism is today.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think there really is amateurism anymore. I think it's either professionalism or poverty, but there's no in between that says you can be an athlete and work, or an athlete and do anything but just be an athlete. So you're either going to get paid as an athlete, or you're going to live in poverty, and there really isn't anything like a gentleman athlete that has a job.
Right.
I don't think that's possible anymore,
because
it just takes too long. Like I said, they really don't even hardly consider you for the rowing team unless you're 23 to 25 years old. And at that point, I would have been out of college for, 3, 4, 5 years. And, I couldn't afford to be married and have kids and things like that and row. So I don't think that amateurism exists anymore.
What has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life?
So it actually pretty minimal. It's something that comes up after you're someplace, but it doesn't open the door, for me, because I left rowing behind me when I left Philadelphia. And so I never, I didn't have a support infrastructure where I was going. Nobody understood rowing or knew anything about it. And frankly, even though I had Olympics on my resume, it didn't say that I graduated with an Olympics degree. It says I had a BS in economics,
Mm-hmm.
And so, the times were hard for jobs then, and So I didn't really get a lot of benefit out of being Olympian. I think I have had more benefit being older and kind of than I did when I was younger.
How so?
Well, because I've so my daughter also rode, and so I attended a lot of regattas with watching her race, and you know, I got to meet some people again, and you know, I kind of got re-enthusiastic about rowing and about, you know, competing and about the national teams and about all those things. And you know, it actually was you know, her getting involved that actually got me involved
in rowing again.
And you know, thinking about being an Olympian again, because you know, for the most part, I never told people I was an Olympian. I just did what I did. And you know, one of the things of not being a medal winner is the first thing people say is, "Oh, did you win a gold?" Well, no, I didn't. I was fifth. So, you know, you don't have that medal you can hang in your living room to show people when they show up.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I think that the advice would be just to find the best coach you can find, and try to get sponsors. You know, try to find people that can support you, because it takes a long time. I was kind of a walk-on in the process, and I don't know that those exist anymore. But get the best coach, put yourself in the right place, so that when it's time to compete, you're already ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Put yourself physically in the right place, and emotionally and mentally in the right place, and also financially in the right place.
What,
because it's like a three-pronged thing.
Yeah. What advice did you give your daughter?
I just to take advantage of all the opportunities she had. She had some real opportunities, and I just, you know, tried to support her where I could, you know, financially and personally, and just told her that if there was an opportunity, just to take advantage of it. And she went to several, you know, pre-selection camps, and she did quite well. She was actually the captain of her crew, so she did very well, and went as far as she wanted to go, and enjoyed it.
Mm. So what do you think about the efforts to reunite members of the 68 Olympic team and kind of the efforts and outcomes of those reunions? What do you think about all of that?
I think they're okay. I you know, so the problem that I have is 68 was a big year for me, you know. So my freshman rowing team gets together every, you know, 5-10 years, you know. So we have a reunion that we'll do on the 50th anniversary of our team, because we were, you know, we're still very, very close, all of us. And, you know, I have my 50th wedding anniversary the same year, and there's always somebody from Pennsylvania that wants to get together for Olympic trials, you know, 1968 Olympian thing. So, you know, there's always three or four reunions that same year. So, oh, and my wife's 50th high school reunion will be the same year. So, so there's a lot of stuff that happens in these kind of every 5 years, you know, or on the big ones anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard for me to attend, and as a fact, you know, I enjoy seeing the names of people that I grew up respecting and caring a lot about. But, you know, I never, for example, Jim Ryan was one of my all-time heroes, you know, and but I don't know that I'd go to a get together to see him because I didn't know him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I did know the people I rode with, and that's probably where I'd probably be more likely to attend.
Mm.
You know, I didn't know anybody but rowers, really, and so it's kind of hard to, you know, to set aside time and money to attend an event where you may only know the rowers there.
Right, that makes sense. Well, Luther, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about to get on the record?
No, I think that my Olympic experiences were, you know, kind of like a lot of people. They were just, for me, they defined me for the rest of my life, and it's hard for me to express to people that in some ways after the Olympics there's not a lot else, you know. You know, what else is there? Well, there's business success, yeah, that's something, but there's a lot of business success, but how many people have ever really been in the Olympics, and how many people have, you know, been in the finals in the Olympics, and how many people have been in two Olympics, and, you know, so for me, that the Olympics has defined the way I think of my life, and I think that I realize it more now than I did then.
That's interesting. Well, Luther, thank you so much for being very generous with your time and your memories today. I very much appreciate it, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
It was nice to speak with you as well.